Attitudes. What do you think of a man who shows up drunk at his own mother's funeral? By Father Joseph C. Martin. Father Martin.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do you do? A couple of years ago in Rockville, Maryland, I was asked to give the Chalk Talk. I've given it some 3,000 times in the last 16 years. And I felt that I had just about memorized it, so I agreed to go over. And when it was done, the group there were parole and probation people. When the talk was done, there were some questions. And one of them was from a young fellow in his 20s, a parole and probation officer, who said, "Thank you. I've learned something, and hopefully we'll be able to use it." But he said, "Information is one thing. Now what do we do? Now what do we do?" So I said, "Well, if you'll ask me back, I will try to tell you how to use it from what I've picked up along the line." So they did ask me back, and what I did in that second talk was what has come to be known as the son of Chalk Talk. I just presented some guidelines for helping the alcoholic, and that's what I'd like to share with all of you today. Ladies and gentlemen, just as all credit must be given where due, and just as most of you know, I tell you that I learned most of what I know in that Chalk Talk from Dr. Green from Detroit. These guidelines have come from a woman that I was privileged to work with for 3 years in Baltimore. Her name is Mrs. Gertrude Nielsen. Gertrude was instrumental in bringing into being the first alcoholism law in the United States, July 68, state of Maryland. And this law relegated alcoholism from the realm of the judicial to the realm of the public health. Mainly, you cannot arrest an alcoholic for publicly displaying the symptoms of an illness. That was a breakthrough. It has since been followed nationally and by many individual states. I would like to give you a bit of background on her so that you will understand where these guidelines have come from. Gertrude's a social worker, spent 20 years on the eastern shore of Maryland, and was then brought into the office of Dr. Isidore Turk, a secretary of health for the state of Maryland. And this man, a Jewish psychiatrist, had dedicated his entire professional career to alcoholics. And he got Gertrude into the field of alcoholism under him. After a few years of working with him, I don't know whether this was for a state report or what, he quite simply asked her if she would write down what she had learned. Now, number one, Gertrude Nielsen is a truly humble person, one of the few I've ever met in my life. She was not out to impress anyone, so she didn't write a book. Have you ever noticed when people want to say something, they write a book with 285 pages? Oh, my God. If it's worth saying, you can say it, you know, in a page and a half. That's just what she did. She wrote it all on one side of one sheet of paper. They were 10 declarative sentences. And she called them her 10 commandments for helping alcoholics. And the only thing that I have done, I was privileged to help present them with her for 3 years when I worked with the state of Maryland. So I have them pretty well memorized. But what I have done, quite simply, is condense them into 8. I simply call them guidelines. They are based on her experience and the experience of many thousands of other people in this field. I would simply like to share them with you. With that as a background, they are not mine. I'm simply funneling them to you. Secondly, I'm positive that most of you are already well aware of them. I'm just saying what you already know. But hopefully, since repetition is indeed the mother of learning, they may get nailed home just a little bit deeper. Now, I'd like to make a few preface remarks about these guidelines. Number one, they are not guaranteed to do anything. And I think you had best bear that in mind. I have given this talk publicly many, many times. And always afterwards, there's a man or a woman in the audience who comes up and almost angry says, "I've tried this." He's still drinking. And the only thing you can say is, "You tried." That's all. They are not guaranteed to do anything. They're not a magic wand that if you do them, this is going to result. But I'll say this without any hesitation. Of those things that might work, these might work best. Of those things that might work, and please remember what might work, these might work best because they're based on experience. It's just as in the case of AA and its 12 steps. Two men desperately trying to remain alive reached out for anything and everything. They kept what worked and threw out what didn't. All of this is a case of trial and error. These things have worked best. They are not guaranteed, therefore, to do anything. Please bear that in mind. Now, secondly, this is from a completely personal and human point of view. I heard fairly recently, and I've used it since, it is too bad that I hear myself only with my own ears. I know what I'm going to say, and I know what the words I'm going to use mean to me, and I know what the ideas mean to me. I'm not too sure you're going to hear them in the same way at all. I'm just not too sure of that. It's too bad I see myself only with my own eyes. Please remember that every one of us here sees and hears and grasps and understands things according to himself. According to himself. And it is perfectly true that two people can look at exactly the same thing and see opposites. Try this on for size one time. I remember I was in the home of a friend of mine up in Seattle not too long ago, and we were talking about this very thing, point of view. And this is why, even though both you and I say things like, well, there are two sides to every question, most of us hear only one. I was in this man's home. We were talking about this, and I picked up a Time magazine. I just held it up between us. I said, Bill, describe to me exactly what you're looking at. And I have a good memory, but it's short, so I don't remember what he was looking at. But anyways, let's just start with this. He said, I see a picture of the President of the United States. I see the word time, and I see a date. I said, now I'll tell you what I'm looking at. It's a picture of Napoleon mounted on a charger, and I'm reading a little ad for Courvoisier Cognac. We were both looking at the same magazine. The point is obvious, isn't it? He was looking at it from his point of view, the front. I was looking at it from mine, the back. Neither one of us saw anything in the middle. All right? A situation can be looked at and talked about and interpreted in two completely different ways. They tell a magnificent story of an old, old millionaire who announced to his lawyer and his family that he intended to marry a 19-year-old child. Well, of course, they hit the roof. They had been through this with him so many times. They argued and argued and got nowhere. That old man was adamant. He was determined he was going to marry this girl. So after about an hour, the lawyer just stood up, and he was really angry. He said, look, old buddy, you do exactly as you want to do. But just remember this. Some of these May December weddings have proven to be fatal. And that old man's eyes nearly come out of his head. He stopped for the longest while, and you could see the wheels churning up there. Finally, he came to his decision. He said, well, if she dies, she dies. You look at it your way, he look at it his. The first guideline for helping alcoholics, acquire proper attitudes towards the alcoholic. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to spend most of my time today on the first of the eight guidelines. Without it, the others are useless. They're useless. And before we get into attitudes toward alcoholics, I'd like to share with you a few things I've picked up over the years about attitudes in general. Number one, we do not have attitudes, they have us. And if you want to prove it, try to get rid of one. You know what a habit is? It is something that has become a part of you through repetition. Most of us are right-handed or left-handed. If you want to prove that habits have you, try to break a physical habit. I get into a jacket, right arm first. Now, it isn't that I can't get into one with the left arm first. 15, 20 minutes, I can get there. Just for fun, just for fun, take one of your habits, whether you eat right-handed or left-handed, and do it the opposite for 3 days. Again, the second day, drive yourself crazy. You know what an attitude is? It's a mental or emotional habit. It's a habit of thinking. It's a habit of judging. It's a habit of feeling. You don't get rid of them. They govern us. Ladies and gentlemen, man has been defined as a rational being, an intelligent animal. And I'm positive that most of us are indeed intelligent. That's simply the distinguishing mark of the human animal. I imagine most of us do our jobs intelligently. I imagine most of you take care of your families and shop and budget and plan for the future and the education of your kids intelligently. But did you know that in every other aspect of life, your feelings, your likes, your dislikes, your opinions, and your attitudes govern you? Face it, my likes and dislikes are what dictate what I choose from a menu. Dictates the kind of clothing I buy. Not me, particularly, but... It dictates what you do with your leisure time. Some people sail, some golf, some read, and so on. Well, it's all likes and dislikes. And when it comes to people, oh boy, oh boy. Face it, ladies and gentlemen, if I like you, I'm going to bend over backwards to rationalize your shortcomings. And if I don't like you, I'm almost eager to believe the worst. Now, I don't want to be that way, but I am. And I don't care who you are, you're that way too. You're that way too. My friends are a result of choice. I choose people I like and I associate with them. So we're that way. I'm not saying anything's wrong with that. I'm just pointing out a simple fact. We do not have attitudes. They have us. How strong are they? Well, they're that strong, and they'll probably die about 20 minutes after we do. They're there. They're there. Now, please, at the beginning of this day, I am not a fool. Don't take me for one. I do not delude myself into thinking or even remotely believing that I can change attitudes of yours that you have spent an entire lifetime building up. All right? But I hope to God to change your minds about a few things. So that even though your gut-level feelings may remain the same, armed with truth, and truth does set us free from the shackles of error, armed with truth up here, I may react a little bit differently to my feelings than I have before. Okay? No. He who is convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. If I've had a pet opinion that I've held for 39 years, and you dare to explode it with truth, it'll die a slow death, if it dies at all. I'm not going to change your attitudes. He who is convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. Have you ever been in an argument? Face it, we thrive on arguments. In an argument, nobody's interested in truth. That's why we get loud. Ladies and gentlemen, I know what's true. It's my opinion. What I'm trying to do is convince you of it. That's what we all do in an argument. I want to believe that what I believe is so. Therefore, it is. A man went to see a psychiatrist once. This is the most perfect illustration I've ever seen or heard. Psychiatrist said, "What seems to be trouble?" He said, "Doctor, I think I'm dead." Well, doctor had never had one of them before. He spent about an hour with that man trying to convince him otherwise, and he couldn't. He couldn't. He was intrigued by this patient. He said, "Look, would you consider coming back to see me again?" The fellow said, "No problem, doctor, when you want to see me." Well, he said, "Don't come back for another 30 days because I want you to do something in the meantime. 3 times a day, look into a mirror and say out loud to yourself, 'Dead men do not bleed.'" He did. He came back, he said, "Doc, here I am. Did exactly as you told me to do. Didn't miss a one, 90 times. Three times a day for 30 days, dead men do not bleed. Doctor said, fine, come here. He took that man's left hand, he isolated his index finger, grabbed a pin and jabbed it. He drew a drop of blood, shoved it onto the guy's face. Man's eyes nearly come out of his head. He said, good heavens, doctor. Dead men do bleed. That's what we deal with when we deal with attitudes. You can change somebody's mind, but it is awfully difficult to change his feelings. Now, in time, feelings may change. Now, I've gone into this at great lengths, and the purpose is obvious. When it comes to alcohol and every facet of it, our attitudes are nailed home. They're pretty deep. They're almost unshakable. And no matter what we say, they govern us and they govern our actions. They are far more deep and far more emotional than you'll ever dream. And my friends, this goes for the attitudes of recovered alcoholics as well as others. What I'd like to do is to spend some time going into your attitudes, and then we'll look at the source of our attitudes just to show you how deep and why they are as deep as they are. Let's take the first. What's your attitude toward drunkenness? Drunkenness. By the way, did you know that there were two kinds? There's the kind that results from alcohol abuse. By the way, we're speaking of knowledgeable people in alcoholism. Many people toss around the words alcohol abuse and alcoholism as though they were interchangeable. And they're not. Wherever you hear the word abuse, you imply freedom of choice. The abuser chooses to drink the way he drinks. He has three choices. He can choose not to drink at all. He can choose to drink a certain amount and quit, or he can choose to get drunk. And the drunkenness that results from alcohol abuse is just that. He chooses to get drunk. By the way, he's the fellow we should judge and don't. We dismiss him. Then there's the drunkenness that results from alcohol addiction or alcoholism. The alcoholic drinks the way he drinks because he can't not drink that way, and he's the one we judge. Let's go back to attitudes. Ladies and gentlemen, you know all this stuff that we're taught about judging the sin, not the sinner, the action, not the actor, the deed, not the doer? That's garbage. We judge people. We judge people. You do, and so do I. I don't want to be that way either, but I am. We use names when Watergate was discussed, right? We didn't judge the actions, we judged the people. That's the way we're built. That's the way we are. Now when it comes to drunkenness, that's an intellectual concept. There's no such thing as drunkenness. There are people who are drunk. They're the ones we judge. What do you think of drunkenness? Is it funny? Right in the beginning, I'm going to discuss humor right now. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a prude. Some of the funniest stories on earth are about drunks. Drunk went up to a parking meter, put his penny in, turned the switch, and it went up to 60. He said, good God, I've lost 120 pounds. My own all-time favorite is about the dear little old lady walked into a bar with her pet goose under her arm, and some lush said, what are you doing in here with that pig? She said, it's a goose, young man. He said, I was talking to the goose. That's what he said. He said that. And then that one's about 89 years old, two drunks walking along a railroad track, and after about 3.5 hours, one said, as the longest stairway I've ever been on in my life. And the other said, these stairs, them damn low railings are killing me. But ladies and gentlemen, you could go on and on this way for hours. There are a whole lot of drunk stories. My point is this. What did you laugh at? What do you laugh at in any story that you laugh at? Whether the subject matter be religion, sex, race, or alcohol, Is it not the funny twist at the end? Good heavens. No one was laughing at the phenomenon of drunkenness. Now, please, can you see a difference between that kind of laughter and this? Dean Martin says swizzle stick, and a whole audience of American morons falls down laughing. The other afternoon on a Merv Griffin show, a little nine-year-old, he was a serviceman, he was about 19. He was an alcoholic, and all the symptoms were there at nine. And he said he used to show up in class drunk. And Merv asked the boy, he said, do you mean to tell me that none of your teachers could spot a nine-year-old drunk? And the audience laughed. And there was a young psychiatrist, former Navy doctor, on that panel, and he busted right in. He said, do you see what we're talking about attitudes, Merv? He said, the audience laughed at that. Here's a child of 9 years with a terminal disease, you know, a killer disease. He said, it could have killed him. They thought it was funny. This is starkly indicative of attitudes toward alcohol in the United States. Did you ever notice, by the way, that some of our laughter is a result of nervousness and ignorance? When you don't know what else to do, you giggle. I'm not against humor. I can appreciate a story with the best. What I'm asking you is, what are your attitudes toward drunkenness? You see a drunk. Is he funny? Is she funny? Hardly. The next time you see a drunk and are tempted to giggle, glance at the wife and see how hilarious it is to her. Or deeper still, the children. You look at a kid and see how funny he thinks his drunken mother is. I'll tell you this, my friends. The attitude is the father of the action. That's why we're talking about attitudes. I act according to attitudes. The attitude is the father of the action. All right? Where you condone drunkenness by laughter, you have a very high rate of alcoholism. Where you condone the use or the abuse, where you condone the abuse of any addictive substance, you have a very high rate of addiction to it. Laughter means condoning. Let's switch, please, to another aspect. Do you think drunkenness is immoral? Most of us, I think, with a Christian background and most with a background in other religions, have read that drunkenness is indeed to be condemned. But again, let's go back to the drunkenness as a result of alcohol abuse or drunkenness as a result of alcoholism. When you see a drunk, does it ever dawn on you to ask which he might be before the judgment is passed? Are all drunks evil simply because they're drunk, whether it's a result of the will or not? If, indeed, you think that drunkenness that is the result of alcohol abuse can be considered immoral, I do. I consider it that. How immoral is it? Let's look at the depth of emotion wrapped up in our attitudes toward every aspect of alcohol. Most people who believe that drunkenness is evil believe it is the most horrible evil conceived or conceivable. Much more evil than robbing a bank. And yet a person who would click her tongue at a restaurant, at a drunk over in the corner who was raising Cain, is the same one who has absolutely no qualms of conscience at all when it comes to lying or detracting from somebody else. Slander means to lie about somebody. To detract means to tell the truth about him. My dad used to always say, I don't give a damn what you say about me, just don't tell the truth. How many of us in this room, and that includes me, how many of us have told the devastating truth about somebody that has practically ruined them, and we got away with it with this magnificent sense of righteousness by saying, well, it is true. And yet we look on drunks as being the most horrible, evil people on earth. Is drunkenness worse than adultery? If indeed you believe that drunkenness is a moral evil, how evil? Does it bespeak of degrees? Okay, let's switch from drunkenness to simple drinking, okay? Drinking alcohol. I was privileged to meet the nephew of one of the co-founders of AA. And he said to me, my uncle got sober when I was four, so I never saw him take a drink. He said all I knew him was as an evangelist who preached against the evils of alcohol. He wouldn't allow it in his home. This is one of the co-founders of AA. What are your attitudes toward the drinking of alcohol? I'm not referring to the abuse of it. I'm not referring to drunkenness. I am talking to the ingestion of an alcoholic beverage. Is it moral or immoral? Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something about morality in me. If I believe that something is immoral and you're doing it and I ain't doing it, I'm a better person than you. I don't want to be that way either, but I am. And so are you. So are you. If you believe that something is bad and somebody else is doing it and you're not doing it, you're a better person. You're better morally. You're a little higher in the hierarchy of rating and rank. We're just that way. Now, what do you believe about drinking alcohol? Is it evil? Because if you believe that, remember, we don't condemn actions, we condemn people, huh? We judge people. If you believe that drinking is evil, you have just condemned about 50% of the human race, for whom bread and wine are staples of life. You have just condemned about 4 or 5 of the major religions on the face of the earth who use wine in the very worship of God. Are they really bad people because they ingest a beverage that you disapprove of? Do you see what I'm after this morning, ladies and gentlemen? For God's sake, examine your attitudes. I'm not here to judge or play God. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I'm asking you to look at what they are. What's your attitude toward alcohol? Is it bad or good? Or can it have any morality about it? Is this microphone morally good or morally bad? I was taught, and I believe, that no inanimate object is either morally good or morally bad. The only thing that has morality attached to it is the will. Some people believe that alcohol itself is evil. And I often wonder what the good God who created it thinks of that. Well, anyway, what are your attitudes? Now, please, let's get to the alcoholic. My friends, you cannot watch a man show up drunk at his own mother's funeral and not have feelings about it. I don't care who you are. Whether you've been recovered from the disease yourself for 28 or 29 years or not, you can't look on that and not have feelings. A 20-year-old girl coming home for a Christmas vacation, finding her mother stark naked, dead drunk, passed out in the middle of the bathroom floor at 3 a.m. on New Year's Eve, can't not have feelings about that. Now, what are your feelings about alcoholics? Well, I know some beautiful attitudes in AA. Well, I ain't going to help that son of a bitch till he asks for it. We ought to shoot people like that. Dr. Bob Smith did not call Bill Wilson for help. Bill called him. And the 12th step of recovery in AA says, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics. It doesn't say we tried to carry the message to those that picked up the telephone, called the central office, and asked us to. Do you see what I'm after about this attitude? About 60% of AA members call it a disease and do not believe it is one. Ladies and gentlemen, a disease can be diagnosed and treated. It can be diagnosed and treated. And yet in AA we say things like, it's a disease of body, mind, emotion, and soul. And in the next breath we say, but I'm not going to help them until they make a rational decision about their state of health. Now who's sick? Just because I happen to be recovered doesn't bring me out of the realm of people who have nutty attitudes. Let me tell you something else about our attitudes, my friends. They're all wrong. Ain't that a kicker? But they're only wrong to a greater or lesser degree. In other words, some people have better attitudes than others because they're armed with a little more knowledge. Now, where do our attitudes come from? We'll go into that just so that we can see why they are as deep and emotional as they are. Basically and fundamentally, the primary source of all attitudes, parental and religious background. And this begins at birth. Parents affect their children. attitudinally speaking. If I like my parents, I will believe and feel much as they do, and if I don't, I'll choose opposite values. But nonetheless, they do indeed affect me this way or that. Let's please look at some major religions and their attitudes toward alcohol and every aspect of it, and I would preface my remarks with these. I am not here to criticize anyone's religious beliefs. Good Lord, I have a few pretty strong ones of my own. I'm just asking you to put your emotion in your pocket and plainly look at the attitude and the result. The attitude is the father of the action. The attitude is the father of the action. And the belief gives birth to the practice. A good friend of mine is a Methodist minister who has dedicated his life to alcoholics. Guess what brought him in to this work? An incident that he heard about that happened in a southern state. I won't tell you what part of the South. One Sunday morning in the middle of a church service, an alcoholic at the end of his rope, he was at the last knot holding on with his fingernails, came running into the church crying and screaming. He needed and wanted help. Well, of course, he made a ruckus, a lot of noise. He said, please, please help me. They threw him out. And a truck hit and killed him right outside their front door. And they're inside singing hymns. The belief is the father of the action. Now, please, let's examine some of our religious attitudes toward drinking, drunkenness, alcoholism, and alcoholics. Let's begin with one of the major religions on earth, Judaism. Ladies and gentlemen, the Jewish people drink wine from birth till death. At table and in their religious ceremonial, they have practically no alcoholism at all. Why we don't learn from them, I don't know. The practice, the way they use alcohol and do not abuse it, I think rests fundamentally on their beliefs about it. Number one, alcohol itself, quotes, the gift of God that gladdens the hearts of men. Number two, they therefore use it accordingly. A Jew would no more dream of abusing alcohol by getting drunk than he would dream of driving an automobile 90 miles an hour through a schoolyard. You just don't do it. It is unacceptable behavior. Therefore, they don't do it. Where you do not tolerate the abuse of alcohol, you have a very low rate of alcoholism. It's that simple, my guy. You don't have to read a book. All you have to do is look. Let's take some of the rest of us. Roman Catholics. Catholic theology, along with its neighbors and cousins, Lutheranism and Episcopalianism, Anglicanism, tolerate, almost to a point of abuse, alcohol. In fact, there's an old saying that where you find four Catholics, there's usually a fifth. Well. Among us all, Catholics, Lutherans, Episcopalians, there's a very high rate of alcoholism. Mormons, Southern Baptists, up until recently Methodists, were Christian sects that forbade the use of alcohol. Now hold on to your chairs. The rate of alcoholism among their ranks is sky high. Sky high. When those whose religions forbid the use of alcohol drink, they drink with guilt. They're sitting ducks. Case in point, the family I live with. The mother is sober in AA 11 years. She's one of 11 children, 10 of whom are alcoholics. The 11th is not. She's scared to death to touch it. Their daddy was a Baptist minister who preached that alcohol is evil, drinking it is worse. When they drank with guilt. You might remember him in your prayers, by the way. May had to bury her dad a couple of months ago. Of Mormons who drink, one out of two contracts the disease. That's from a government survey, and you can find all these statistics in a book called Alcohol Problems, A Report to the Nation by Dr. Thomas Platt. It's all in there, I'm just voicing them. Family and religion. Take Islam Muslims are forbidden to drink. Of those who do, one out of three contracts the disease. I got this from a Muslim I met back in Maryland. A friend of mine at an ARC, an alcohol rehab center in Norfolk, Virginia, United States Navy, did a one-question survey of the patients. They had 70 patients. Exactly 30 were Roman Catholics, exactly 30 were Southern Baptists. One religion condones the use of alcohol, one forbids, and they both supplied the same percentage of patients. I remember at a ministerial meeting on alcoholism, it was an educational thing, one minister put his hand up and kind of smiling at the absurdity of it, he said, in my church there is no alcohol problem. As soon as someone contracts the disease, we deny him membership. So of course we have no... By the way, I didn't say that to be funny or critical at all. The man was simply stating a fact of life in his own religion. Now please watch this added something. Race, culture, social background, and so all of these nebulous but very definable things also enter into it. Let's go to Europe to watch a rather startling phenomenon. France and Italy, geographically, are neighbors. In fact, the border towns, I think their peoples are bilingual. They are both Catholic by faith. They are Latin by blood. Genetically, they're cousins. And they both use wine as their national beverage. France has one of the highest rates of alcoholism in Europe, and Italy one of the lowest. And the reason is simplicity itself. France condones drunkenness. Italy does not. The belief is the father of the practice. In Italy, you do not get drunk. It is unacceptable behavior. You just don't do it. And here in America, we condone almost anything. If in no other way than by silence, we say nothing. Therefore, it's all right. We condone almost anything. We in America are heirs to the classical American temperance movement. Now, I'd like to go into that because it was all explained to me by a young Methodist minister friend of mine. He said this to me. If the founding fathers of the temperance movement could see what we've done to it, he said they'd turn over in their graves. Ladies and gentlemen, do you know what the word temperance means? It refers to the responsible use of alcohol. Temperance in all things is an ideal and a virtue. You do or should do everything temperately. But after it was in existence about 20 minutes, it became an abstinence movement. There's a vast difference between temperance and abstinence. Do you know how it came into being? Well, first of all, the movement came into being through a looking at the abuse of alcohol. A century ago, America was not a whiskey, was a whiskey drinking country because they couldn't preserve beer and wine very well. So they drank an awful lot of whiskey. They were pioneers. They worked hard. They played hard. They drank hard. The results were obvious. Alcoholism. Broken homes, broken bodies, broken families, broken heads, on and on and on. And so this religion came to a conclusion that we should do something about this. Let's drink temperately. But from a condemnation of alcoholism, they went to a condemnation of alcoholics, from the deed to the doer. From a condemnation of drinking, which they believe caused it, to a condemnation of drinkers. And then the ultimate. They passed a moral judgment on an inanimate object. They condemned alcohol. The belief gave birth to these practices, calling alcohol demon rum. It is evil. The lips that touch liquor will never touch mine. And on and on and on. Now, many of us in this room are heirs to a greater or lesser degree to these movements and so on. I'm not saying whether they're right or wrong. I'm saying they're there. Let's take our racial and cultural background. We have already seen the Jews, the French, and the Italians. The American Indian was a sitting duck. He had no past cultural usage of alcohol. Ladies and gentlemen, the West wasn't one with Winchester rifles. It was one with barrels of whiskey. Barrels of whiskey conquered this country. Most of us, I think, are from, it's the only one I know to talk about, a European background. French, Polish, German, Italian, English, Irish, whatever. Most of us should be bilingual, and we're not. Go back in your family, I think that you will find, for some of you anyway, the great-grandparents absolutely refused to teach the native tongue to the child. He didn't want him to grow up with an accent and be ridiculed. When I taught out here for many years, there were many boys in class that should have spoken Spanish. They didn't. Most of our forebears were peasants, face it. And they came over to this country for many reasons, one of which was to eat better. You know, you can idealize all that goop as you want, but they came over to eat better. And they were looked down on by the clowns that had come over here before. And you know who they were? The horse thieves that arrived 20 years earlier. They had to work hard, so they played hard, they sinned hard, and they drank hard. The result? Let me give you one, for instance. My closest friend on earth is married to a little Polish girl from South Baltimore whose daddy worked in the steel mills. He came home on Friday night, he gave his paycheck to his wife, he got an allowance, and he got drunk on the weekend. And Nancy knew that when she grew up, that would be exactly her life. And there would be a beating or two thrown in. Because that's what happened in her neighborhood and her home, and she simply took it for granted as a way of life. And it was. Now, my friends, you want to know where your strongest attitudes come from? Personal experience. Personal experience. I was at an AA meeting giving the blackboard talk about a year and a half ago, and I got talking about emotions and so on and so forth. After it was over, a woman came up to me in tears. She said, "I have been in Al-Anon 11 years. I have never forgiven him one syllable that he ever said to me or anything that he ever did to me during the years that he drank." Attitudes? Okay, let's switch back to the graveyard. Suppose the guy drunk at his own mother's funeral happens to be your brother. How many of you in this room have had a parent, either a mother or father, show up drinking or drunk at an important day in your life, like a graduation or your wedding or whatever? Our attitudes toward alcoholics are pretty strong, my friends. Listen to the language of the dedicated recovered alcoholic, and you'll find out just what his attitudes are, too. "Well, he doesn't want it. Let him go." Here I am playing God again. How dare I judge any human heart? How do I know what he wants? He's so sick. But boy, he offended me by getting drunk that last time. I'm sore at that. And by God, I treat him accordingly. This is not a criticism of people in general. It is just picking out human failings. I'm loaded with them. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not a good 12-stepper, so I don't do it. I'm on the road all the time. I couldn't give the time to an alcoholic anyway. I'm too impatient to work with a drunk. Far too impatient. And when you work with a drunk, you're playing with another human life. Beware. Beware. But by the way, I'm sure that you are here in this room because you're interested in alcoholics. Let me give you one guide. I remember at a meeting one time, we asked the man who saved my life, "Well, Rip, how far do you go with a drunk?" And he shot back. He says, "As far as you can." And then one step more. I have seen him live this. I'm not big enough to. That's not humility, it's a statement of fact. I'm not big enough to do that. But I've seen him do it, and I've seen him save lives with the one step more. So forget all your bloody discussions about that. Where there is human life involved, I should be led accordingly. One step more. Let me show you just how deep personal experience can hammer home an attitude in a human soul. I know of a nurse who has done emergency room work for about 20 to 21 years at this point. This is her background. As an orphan, she was raised by an alcoholic uncle and his wife, her aunt. And this man, when he drank, became a rather obnoxious wife beater and child beater. You imagine this little 6-year-old girl getting pummeled by a 200-pound drunk? That was her background. The result? Here's a woman whose life is dedicated to human suffering and the alleviation of it. She sees her uncle in every sick alcoholic they wheel into that hospital, and she treats him accordingly with utter contempt. Utter contempt.
Is her attitude wrong?
Yes.
But is it understandable? You bet your bottom dollar it's understandable. And that's what I say about all of us and our attitudes. They're all wrong to a greater or lesser degree, but they're all understandable. Positing our parents, our religion, our race, our cultural background, and our personal experience. I only ask you to look at yours, see what they are. Now, please, what's the conclusion to all this? We've looked at attitudes, we've looked at where they come from. What are we to conclude from it? Well, I'll tell you. Let's just begin with this simple consideration. God Almighty has not yet gone on vacation and appointed either me or you to fill in. So I'm not put on this earth to judge. But I know this. We are indeed committed in conscience. We are committed in conscience to love. Now, spell it, and of course everybody uses the word love. Nobody knows what the hell it means. But anyways, basically to love is to give. We are committed to the alleviation of human suffering. I beg you, let's let this be a basic attitude. What can I do to help? That's all. Let's start with that one. What can I do to help? Positing all of my feelings, what can I do to help? I'm not here to judge. I'm here to help. Let's let that be a basic. Now, before we end this first session, I would just like to toss this cutie pie into your laps for consideration. If the primary source of all of our attitudes is parental, and if basically your attitudes toward every aspect of alcohol are what your parents were, where do you think your kids are going to get theirs? Try this single question on for size. Who of you in this room would want a son or a daughter to grow up to be exactly like you? My God, that's terrifying. I wouldn't want anybody to grow up to be exactly like me. Your attitudes are important, my friends, because they will dictate the way you act, and also they will dictate how you form the attitudes in others. But anyway, let's take a break and we'll pick up next session.